go through these issues alone, and we need each other to come up with solutions.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Mi gwech for joining us today. Native Lights is at its core a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Every week we have wonderful conversations with great guests from a whole lot of different backgrounds. These are artists, community leaders, healthcare advocates, you name it. We talk to them about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it centers around this, you know, big point of finding purpose and sharing gifts. So I can't wait to continue amplifying Native voices. How are you doing, Leah?
I'm great. How are you?
Super great, you know, just chilling.
I'm convincing people left and right of my greatness.
So I know a lot of focus, you know, with urban natives is kind of centered around the cultural corridor in Minneapolis, but there is a Native community in Duluth, Leah.
You betcha.
And there's Native communities everywhere, of course. But and our next guest is helping a lot in that community. And so I'm very excited to speak with her about all the work that she's doing in the Duluth area on the shores of Lake Superior. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited to speak with our guest today. Her name is Leanne Littlewolf. Leanne Littlewolf is a Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe citizen and co-executive director for the American Indian Community Housing Organization in Duluth, near the shores of Gitche-Gumee, also known as Lake Superior. She says she provides an indigenous approach to community and economic development, as well as an expertise in trauma-informed, culturally-based strategies. So can't wait to hear more about her story and all the things that she's doing in the community. And here she is. Bonjour, Leanne.
Bonjour, Hanin. I'm Leanne Littlewolf, Indigenous Kaz Jaganashimowin and Sokiyajik Indigo, Mayungan Indu Dame, and Gazago Squaj and Kagna Unjiba. And I use she, her pronouns, but my traditional name is Everyday, and I belong with the Wolf Clan, and I come from Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I'm a tribal citizen, and I am the co-executive director for AICO, which is the American Indian Community Housing Organization.
To the American Indian Community Housing Organization, could you just talk about how it all began? I know in 1993, it was founded. Could you just tell us how it began and how it's evolved since then?
Yeah, I wasn't around when this organization started. And how I understand it is that there was a few Native community members who were at a community meeting up at the Damiano, which is like a social service center. They had been in that meeting and they felt frustrated that there wasn't a lot of emphasis on Native issues. So they left the meeting and they went out in the parking lot and they were talking about the things that they wished for. And then they're like, and we're in a parking lot. Like, this is our meeting spaces in this parking lot. So from that is my understanding is that they decided to start a nonprofit organization, and it was established in 1993, became a 501c3 organization. The first thing that AICO focused on was emergency shelter for people that were fleeing violence. And so they started with Dabanu Event Shelter, which is a 10-bed shelter. They purchased a single family home and renovated it to shelter space. And so that's been up and running since the mid-1990s. And then, shelter stays are usually 30 days. It's not enough time for people to really get on their feet. And a lot of times when someone leaves like an unsafe situation, you know, you're leaving with what you can grab. It's usually not much. So to, you know, just think about rebuilding your life and grabbing like maybe a backpack and just throwing whatever you can and getting out to save your life. Like, you know, that's the situation a lot of survivors are in. So the next thing that AICO did is they purchased an apartment complex and they turned it into transitional housing. So then shelter residents could have access to that transitional housing. And, you know, and that's usually lasts for like a year to 2 years, helps you get on your feet, and then you can move into permanent housing.
So it started as like mainly geared towards housing, correct? And then now there's like all these different programs within it. Could you talk more about the additional programs that have come out of ACO?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is like when you have access to community space, there's so many things that are possible. There's so many things that you can do. And so downtown Duluth, the YWCA had built this building in the around the turn of the century, early 1900s. And it's a historic building. And they decided that they wanted to sell it. And so ACO was in position to buy it and purchased the building in 2007. And worked on renovating it for like 5 years, had to raise like over $8 million to renovate it. And this space, you know, it's huge. There's like a big gym. There's a swimming pool. It's not used anymore, but there's a lot of space in the lower level. We have a community center. We have a rooftop that we actively use, and there's a lot of office space. And then there were single room occupancies. So they were SROs, and they were put in place because the reason the YWCA had built this building was that they had heard, the women in Duluth had heard that there were young women who were coming to Duluth, getting off at the depot, and they were coming here for work. And it was young immigrant women. And then they were going missing. Nobody knew where they were, and they were just gone. So the women get together and they raise money to build this building, and they wanted young women to have a safe place to go. So they would send people down to the train, go and meet the young women, bring them up, and then they could rent an SRO. And they did a lot of like employment support and those kinds of things. So the building itself has a lot of history around like responding to community need. And so when ACO moved into this building in 2012, they renovated the SROs into 29 units of permanent supportive housing. So there's efficiency, 1-bedroom, 2-bedroom, and 3-bedroom apartments on site. So we have 29 households that live on site, and that's like single adults, families with children. You know, we usually have anywhere from 30 to 40 adults and anywhere from 40 to 60 children that live on site. So this is their home. And then community space. So we have what used to be the Trepanier Hall, which was a really beloved community space. It was, people had candidate forums, and they had folk dances, and they had the Unitarian Universalist Church met there. I mean, it was used for many different purposes. We renamed it the Dr. Robert Paulus Cultural Center. And before the pandemic, we would have over 300 different community events in that space. So this building, the Gamaji Manoba Ma Dizzy Min building, has become like a community hub. And when you have community come in, community brings their ideas, they bring their vision, they bring their energy. And so that's really when you're talking about the different programming, it all has stemmed from our Indigenous community. That's how our arts and cultural programming started. That's how our children's and youth programming. We do a food sovereignty initiative. We have social enterprises. We have we do gardening on site. We have a health equity initiative, which really came as a result of the pandemic.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're speaking with Leanne Littlewolf, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe citizen and co-executive director for the American Indian Community Housing Organization in Duluth.
Leanne, could you just talk about, you know, being the co-executive director at the organization? Like, how does that work? And I know, how is it like to work with co-executive director Michelle Lebeau?
So I worked at ACO in 2017. I started working here in 2017, and I took on a role as an advocate training specialist, and it was really focused on addressing sexual violence and domestic violence and community violence, and coming up with training to help our whole community respond better to American Indian survivors. And I did that role for a year, and then I became the economic development director. And there was some really direct connections between the year that I spent doing research on violence and trying to figure out like how, first, we have extraordinarily high experiences of with violence. And I while I was doing that research and thinking about doing the trainings, I had to really connect that to my own life. And so I started thinking about when I was a little kid and how much violence I saw as a little kid. And it was normalized, even though it's the most abnormal. Those are the most abnormal experiences. And I realized that no one throughout my whole life had ever talked with me about that. Nobody helped me make sense out of that. Nobody helped me put that into a context or a perspective. Nobody helped me make like meaning of how I could like repair myself and also continue in the world in a good way. And so I realized like I had been left unattended as a child through that, and as an adolescent and as a young adult. And I thought, like, how many of our community members have experienced that? I'm kind of wondering, but it all is tied together, because those, you know, in leadership, you have to care about the issues that impact our people, and you have to care about the issues that impact that. And a lot of times they're the unspoken issues. And it's really easy to follow trends and say like what everybody else is talking about. It's a little bit harder to really pay attention to like where our people, what the issues are. And a lot of times they're invisible for a long time. So I think about the issue of missing murdered Indigenous relatives, right? Which started out as missing murdered Indigenous women. And, you know, we had something really horrific happen in my family to my grandma. And as a child, it had such a deep impact on me, and I never spoke about it. And I think about that incident almost on a daily basis, and have done that my entire life. And I always thought that my family, this was like a very abnormal experience that nobody else went through. And there was like a lot of stigma with it. So I never talked about it, not even with my other family members. And then when there was legislation proposed for the Missing Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force, we went down, ACO staff, myself and another staff, we went down to the hearings. And we heard Native women testify, and the same similar stories, different stories, but heart-wrenching, heartbreaking stories. And after that hearing, we all went out into the hallway and we sobbed and we held each other. And I realized like our issues are so urgent. Our issues are so complex, and we cannot go through these issues alone. And we need each other to come up with solutions. So in my leadership here at ACO, I'm excited to work with my community. I'm excited that I'm in a position that I've been working my whole life to figure out how you run a nonprofit organization, and how do you secure resources, and how do you put good ideas into action, and how do you work with others in a good way? Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
I wanted to ask about the mural outside of the building in Duluth, that big, beautiful, powerful mural. Could you just talk about, I mean, if you could, talk about that mural and just how that came to be?
Sure. I think that Hannah Smith was working with Honor the Earth, and they wanted to do a large public mural in Duluth. And they approached ACO to see if we would partner. And Honor the Earth had a connection with an artist collective called Insurgents. And so it just kind of came together. And we had a space up on our rooftop on a wall. And Insurgents showed up. It was Voltan, Derek, and Leah. And they had, they talked through like, what should this, it was co-designed, I guess. And it was like, they came through with these ideas. And then they really wanted to have a message about protecting the water and the importance of our water. And I think that the artists, they listened to the community, and they started to pull together all of these different ideas around, you know, Anishinaabe women's role with protecting the water, and the issue with resource extraction, and how a lot of times that's associated with violence towards women and missing, murdered Indigenous women, and how that we're aware of those connections, but the wider community often isn't. And how can we protect our water if we're not protecting our women? And so there's a lot of complex ideas in that mural. And it's also around visibility, that we are here, and that's the first large scale public art piece created by Indigenous artists, you know, in our city. So that's really important too. You know, we have like statues and we have different things, different art pieces that have been, they look Native, but they're created by non-Native artists. So, you know, there's that issue. I think since the mural has been up, you know, has brought a lot of attention to those issues, and then also brought a lot of like recognition for Indigenous art. And we have more Indigenous art now in Duluth than ever before. Like if you go to the Gitche Oday Park, there was a collective artist who worked on the different murals there. And so it's just been really incredible to see Duluth be a place where our art flourishes.
You talked about, you know, the mural and it bringing awareness to certain issues to the wider public. Could you just talk about that maybe a little bit more? And just are there other, you know, ways that maybe this organization is bringing about awareness of issues in order to tackle that?
Yeah, I think that we're a community organization, and like we went to present at this there's a community grant fund, and we went to present, and there was a lot of community people there, and they had never heard of our organization. So we were a little astounded because we've been here for so long, but there was not awareness that we exist. So we either have like ACO, you guys are great and you guys do incredible work and there's a lot of recognition. And then there's like no recognition. So that's like this really strange continuum, right? So we're right downtown. We're very visible. I don't know. It just astounded us. So, but the way that as a community organization that we work on a lot of these issues is like we will have community gatherings. So like ACO put on around like climate change. We had an artist showcase. And that brought in like artists from all over the place who had just this different expressions and different, just beautiful, incredible art. Just, and then art, you know, speaks in a different way to us, you know, and it evokes like our emotional response. It engages our thinking in a different way. It challenges us. It does so many different things. So you can walk in front of a visual piece or they got so many different ways that there's art. It engages the community to think deeply about those issues. We've had like a modern dance performance here with Rosie Simmons on DNA and historic trauma. I mean, that was incredible. It was a free event. And a lot of our events are cross-cultural. So there's people from many different like cultural perspectives who come. So you get like this like learning. It's like this mutual learning. I don't know. So we do that. And then we do some advocacy. Like I said, we went down to the legislature to support this task force, and then so excited to see when it finally passed. And then they had that task force and they came out with a report. So we helped share out that report. And then the office was initiated. And we also work, you know, as we're allies with other community groups. So we also wanted to see the office for the African-American women, you know, who have been missing and murdered. And it's not like we have, we want to lift up all of these issues. And then there's still, you know, we have community members who are missing and we need attention on that. But other ways that we lift up issues, I would say like one of the biggest ones in the last several years has been food sovereignty. And, you know, I started here in 2017, and ACO had already started some really great practices. So, like I said, we have a permanent supportive housing program that's on site, and the staff early on decided that they weren't going to offer free, you know, like high sugar foods. So when they started a pantry, it has staples in it. There was a food truck that would go around where they could pull food off of it. They made a decision not to take sugar foods. They took fresh foods and they started cooking meals on site. So they had started that. There was garden boxes that were built by staff that had woodworking skills. They just said, well, we'll just make some garden boxes. And they started planting. And then people gifted ACO with traditional plants. So there's sweet grass, there's sage, there's tobacco. And then those are opportunities to teach about those plants and what they mean to us and how they help us. And we have had, historically, we've had a lot of cultural disruptions and some families and some individuals we don't grow up knowing. It's not our fault. So anytime that we can always do, we can always learn. So it's great to have the kids help gather the sage. We talk about the practice of smudging. We talk about plants as our relatives. And then those kind of early practices grew to now there's like veggies and herbs and perennials that grow up on the rooftop and then in a back garden. And then the youth, take that and they go to farmers market with it, and they also create products with it. We had a visitor come from Pine Ridge, Nick Hernandez, who came to talk about how there's so many entrepreneurship opportunities through like food systems work. And it was like these young girls who came and they were talking about the lotions that they were making and the hand salves that they're making. And they just jumped up and started talking about the different plants that they used and what the properties of that plant were and like why they were using it. And, they're gaining like all this traditional plant knowledge, and it's incredible. So I think that's, you see our culture come back in a really powerful way. And then food sovereignty is our right. It's our right to our foods. It's our right to have knowledge about our foods. It touches so many different issues. It's about our environment and the quality of our environment. We should have clean water to have our rice in. The stuff that's going on with the climate is really concerning with our foods. So it kind of connects to a lot of different issues.
Is there some overlap with the Indigenous First Gift Shop and foods? Because I remember Cole asked me a couple years ago, where can I get a big old bundle of sage? Mm-hmm. I was like, Indigenous First Gift Shop. Is there some overlap then with the gift shop?
Yeah. So the gift shop started ACO started with the art gallery and started doing art shows with artists. And then that merged into this Indigenous First Art Gallery gift shop. And the focus was on art. And then we purchased a corner grocery store and we're going to turn it into an Indigenous food market. And so it takes time to do a development like that. So in preparation, we had like a small bookshelf that had some Indigenous food on it. And that has grown to a corner of the gift shop. And it's incredible the amount of revenue that has been generated both by the art and the food. And I would say that they really exceeded, the revenue has exceeded like anything that I would have thought of. And 2/3 of it goes back directly to the artists and the entrepreneurs. So there's that. And then we're building relationships with food producers so we can get ready for that market to open. So we started a winter market, and then that turned into a summer market. And again, the focus was on art and food. And those are incredible events. And then every year, ACO would have a baboon market. So in November, there would be a market with vendors. And what it is it's like easy access retail space, so it's like for emerging and established entrepreneurs to come in and to like showcase their work. And they usually sell out. So it's pretty incredible. I would say that with Indigenous First, the shop started with about 20 to 30 different artists that were featured. We have two coordinators, co-coordinators. It's Avery Makes Room for Them and Cayman Good Sky. And I asked Cayman to add, like, can you tell me how many people are featured in the shop? It's 129. So, in 2017, it was about 30. We're in 2022, 129. And once our community saw that they could have access to retail space, community members started to innovate and bring in high quality products. So I would say like even people who never thought that they would be like an entrepreneur were like, well, I have this great idea. And like one of my favorite stories is came and said, hey, I want to see like baby clothes that are like indigenous and like have our art and our ideas. And what do you think of that? I said, well, it'd be great if you sketched up some ideas and like just go from there. And so within a couple hours came back and said, well, I have these three designs and they were great designs. And so then came and took those and got them vectored by a local artist and then researched where to get onesies and then where to get them printed. And within 2 weeks had them on the shelf, on the shelves in the store, and they sold. And so, and it was like, resiliency. It was around like predisposed to learning my language. I mean, they were like really, they were takes on like the negative stereotypes with us and then turning them into these like positive strengths that were for babies, you know, messages for and hopes for babies. So that's one example, but there's like many examples, and we have so many either they've been established, but they just haven't had retail space. And then we have emerging entrepreneurs who are just like, yeah, I could do this. And that's the whole hope with the Niwin market. A nonprofit can build a community-owned business. And what I hope is that other people in our community will say, well, ACO did that, but I don't want to do that. And I can do that. And we need to see more Native businesses.
Thank you very much for your time today, Chimi Gwech. If you have any, you know, final thoughts you'd like to say with, you know, the organization or just any future events that are happening or anything like that, let us know.
Well, then, I want to say to both of you, like, thank you for having this radio show. I listened to the show. You did an interview with Kim and Goodsky, and I would listen to that interview like multiple times. And I would listen to that interview with my grandson. So we listened to your show. Like,
awesome.
Yes.
So
thank you for doing this. So, and I, it's nice to meet both of you.
Leanne Little Wolf, everybody. It's great to see all, to hear about all the great work she's doing in Duluth and how that organization is, you know, has evolved, and it's evolved with community there. So,
absolutely. I have been looking forward to talking to Leanne. I know I've admired her work from afar, and yeah, it's really great to speak with her.
Yeah, so thank you to Leanne Little Wolf, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Citizen and Co-Executive Director for the American Indian Community Housing Organization in Duluth. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening.
Gigawabamin.
Native Lights, Where Indigenous Voices Shine, is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Afrofuturistic Herstory, the Griot series, returns to the Cedar Cultural Center Monday, February 20th. February's Griot series features Alicia Steele, Tierra Oso, Body Prayers artist Deja Joel, our storyteller brother Ashe, Yvette Grafia Gray, Spoon in Theory Handmade, Duka Yamama, The Horny Human, and more. Don't miss the February 20th Griot series at the Cedar Cultural Center. That's THECEDAR.ORG. The Griot Series, Afrofuturistic Herstory, at the Cedar Cultural Center, Monday, February 20th at 7 p.m.
When everyone zigs, it's cool to zag. So here's a sample of the kind of music that KFAI doesn't play. Yep, that's right. KFAI plays just about every type of music from around the world. It's an audio encyclopedia for you through your radio or smart device at kfai.org. There's a whole world full of music out there, and KFAI brings it to you every hour of every day. Welcome to the 21st century, KFAI, Perpetual Zag.
Welcome to Colonisters, a program by people of color for people of color and everyone else. I'm Halee Lee, owner of the Other Media Group and Vice President of Programming at Ampers.
I'm Anthony Galloway, Senior Partner of the Dendros Group and Pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota.
I'm Don Eubanks, Associate at Dendros Group and member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians.
And Luz Maria Fears cannot join us today following a loss in her family. We want her to know we're thinking of her and we love her, and hopefully we'll have her back with us again soon. Joining us is Amelia, who has been a guest with us before, and she will be sitting in. So I'll have Amelia introduce herself.
My name is Emilia Gonzalez-Avalos. I am a nonprofit operator. I am a mother of three, a grandmother of two, and I am an immigrant to Minnesota from Mexico City.
And our guest this week, a very special guest,